content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello there and welcome back. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. We're now going to return to the September 2021 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month is preserved, and there's lots of articles about food, not just preserved food, this month. But you know what I'm going to do? I never finished the pictorial last week because it was quite long, and I was a little long-winded at points describing some of the pictures, and it seems like there's a lot of good information here, so I'm going to continue reading the pictorial articles here. And the first is entitled Ocean Treasures, and it's referring to a town that I have never heard of, despite living in North Carolina since 1981, Mayodan. So, it says, when Vicky Wall began collecting seashells as a little girl, they were just seashells in a small basket. Now, though, the 62-year-old Mayodan woman's shell game has evolved dramatically. She figures she has a couple thousand seashells of every shape and color, all of them meticulously cleaned and cataloged with exotic names like whelks, conches, hairy tritons, and wintle traps. They range in size from the tiny keyhole limpet, which is about a quarter of an inch long, to the left-handed whelk, which is 12 inches. Also among Wall's favorites is the Scotch bonnet, North Carolina State's seashells, North Carolina's state seashell, a distinction initiated in 1965 by the North Carolina Shell Club, to which she belongs. Wall got serious about collecting in the early 1980s after her parents bought a condo on Topsail Island, giving her unfettered access to the Carolina coast and its shelling riches. North Topsail, Portsmouth Island, and Shackleford Banks have been especially generous to her, she says, and the best times to hunt are at low tide or immediately after a strong nor'easter. I really enjoy the discovery aspect of it, Wall says. You never know what you're going to find walking on the beach. Close-up pictures of seashells, of course, are what's with the article. Among the shells collected by Vicky Wall, who is seen here holding a knobbed whelk, are, in the close-up, a shark's eye moon snail, pardon me, which is the back of a swirl that comes up to a tiny little point, but there are many, many subtle colors in this shell. It's very unusual in the pastel nature of the colors and how they all swirl together and come to this tiny little point at the top. A shark's eye moon shell, a Scotch bonnet found on Portsmouth Island, and a pair of angulate wintle traps and a lion's paw scallop. So I'm not sure what is a wintle trap here. Angulate wintle traps. These are very unusual. It looks like if you put your finger over the hole, it looks like the top end of a Dairy Queen ice cream cone, except instead of the swirls going around, they go straight up toward the top. So it's almost like a candle that's flickering. And I guess that's a wintle trap. And the lion's paw scallop, of course, would be a regular scallop shell with a flat base at the bottom, curving up into this triangular structure, which goes out and has the ridges all over it. The Scotch bonnet I do recognize also. And I'm just a little confused about what a shark's eye moon snail is. Maybe that's what that little white thing is, and the wintle traps look like little strands of icing floating along. Anyway, time to turn the cover, to turn the page to the next page, and get on to Birds of a Feather in Charlotte. Krogie Anderson grew up hunting waterfowl in eastern North Carolina, but it was actually his wife who got him interested in hunting the waterfowl he's best known for, duck decoys. Anderson, who now lives in Charlotte, once owned upwards of 1,300 hand-carved wooden decoys before whittling his collection back to about 1,000 now, most of them made by carvers from North Carolina and Back Bay, Virginia, and almost all of them carved prior to 1950. The entire obsession, collection, can be traced back to a single decoy bought by Anderson's wife in 1979 to decorate their new home. Anderson said it was actually kind of ugly, but it was enough to spark his interest. He returned that decoy and started buying ones that were more to his liking. Ducks, geese, swans, shorebirds. And once he started up, he couldn't stop. I guess it's kind of in my DNA to collect them, Anderson says. Two nationally acclaimed North Carolina carvers in particular, Lee Dudley and James Best, top Anderson's list of favorites. He's even written 4 books on North Carolina decoys and was able to draw from his own flock for the illustration. Double page spread here of Anderson and his decoys says Krogie Anderson stands in front of a wall of decoys from Ocracoke in Carteret County. The circa 1930s pintail drake he's holding was carved by Alvin Harris, who helped turn hunting decoys into an art form. So they're all stacked on the walls. I guess they're sitting on little acrylic shelves, so they haven't been in any way penetrated to put on the wall. They're sitting on the shelves, which have little spikes, I guess, which go on the wall. They're all lined up at slightly different heights along the back wall, and Anderson, in his bright pink short-sleeved shirt, is holding a very large, or to me, a very large duck decoy, which is sort of a greenish color with little black wing marks, a black tail, black head, and a patch of white coming up on the front. Earth and Fire in Mills River. It's been nearly half a century since Rodney H. Leftwich discovered the regional folk pottery traditions of western North Carolina. But his passion for the art remains as enduring as the deep-rooted tradition itself. Leftwich, who lives in Mills River, launched what would evolve into an 1,100-piece collection of antique western North Carolina pottery, beginning with a piece created in the 1870s. The collection includes crocks, urns, and other utilitarian pieces, and early face jugs, but he also developed an affinity for the lesser-known art pottery style recognized for its artistic flair. A number of years ago, Leftwich downsized his collection to about 300 pots. My favorite pieces, he says, but he didn't downsize his enthusiasm. Leftwich, who also makes his own pottery, especially favors the work of the late Walter Stephen, who founded Pisgah Forest Pottery near Asheville in the early 1920s. Stephen became known for discovering new, previously unknown glazes and colors, and for incorporating decorative folk life drawings into his pieces. For Leftwich, the joy of collecting pottery is a never-ending one. What I have loved about collecting has not been the pottery, says, but the hunt. So here are some of the pieces. They are predominantly blue, pretty much the same shade of blue. There are some lighter shades in the background, and those would tend to be greenish. These pieces, there are a tea set in front with a teapot, the creamer, and the salt sugar dispenser, and then there's some water or milk pitchers behind them and some larger jugs behind them. What's interesting is each one of these has little figurines embedded into the surface. Every single one of them that's shown here does, with one exception. The teapot, for instance, has a horse and wagon, and there's even a whip coming out from the front of the wagon by the person getting those oxen or whatever animals that are pulling it, I can't tell from the distance, going, and there's a tree that's bending in the wind there. And the same figure is redone on the sugar bowl and the cream dispenser. But on the milk or water dispensers, there are people walking. There are two people that are playing trumpets, and somebody's carrying what looks to be a turkey, and then two children carrying something in their hand, and an adult following them behind, and the one on the right, people dancing. And these are rather unusual to me, at any rate. And here's Rodney Leftwich on the photo on the right, having the special affinity for the work of Walter Stephen, including this 1915 vase, which is a dark green with white flower and a couple of stalks coming up beside the flower. And crystalline glazed and cameo decorated wares that I just described that represented Stephen's childhood experiences going west in a covered wagon, and that explains that. And now we're on to a fan of fizz in Mooresville. Mark Ridenour jokes that his mum put cheer wine in his baby bottle, which is comical, of course, until you catch a glimpse of the cheer wine shrine, his home office, at Ridenour's house in Mooresville. Spilling over with so much cheerwine memorabilia that you wonder if he is, in fact, joking about that baby bottle. It's pretty much an obsession, he says. He grew up in Salisbury, birthplace of the beloved soft drink. I collect any and all things cheerwine. His collection ranges from small items like cheerwine bottle caps, bottle openers, and refrigerator magnets, to large signs and even the hood of the former cheerwine race car of NASCAR fame. Ridenour has all shapes and sizes of cheerwine bottles, including a few examples of what he calls the Holy Grail, the cherries bottle. It's adorned with an image of three cherries, which was produced only in 1917, the company's first year of existence. There's much more. Shirts and hats, watches and clocks, vending machine inserts, serving trays, an empty carton of cheerwine swirl ice cream, even a three-foot-tall Santa wearing a cheerwine belt buckle. And, of course, the circa 1930s cheerwine outdoor thermometer that launched Ridenour's obsession more than 25 years ago. It's kind of crazy, he says. I've always loved the drink itself, but now I have this appreciation for its history also. Pictured here, Mark Ridenour's collection includes cheerwine bottles from 1917 to the present, a bench from the 50s, a vending machine insert from the 80s, a 1986 tennis trophy from a tournament sponsored by cheerwine, and posters from the Salisbury Centennial. And here he is in his bright red cheerwine shirt. Of course, it says cheerwine on it. They probably gave him that one. And he's leaning on this giant bottle cap that says drink. Cheerwine, soft drink, registered trademark. And there's several other signs behind him on both sides and that 1986 trophy. And I think we have come to the end because we've come to an advertisement for PBS North Carolina, pbsnc.org, premiering a show called The Key Ingredient with Sherry Castle on September 23rd. Explore Our State with a new series featuring the celebrated food writer and cooking teacher. In every episode, Sherry welcomes a host of guests and shares approachable recipes using local ingredients. And now we move on to some of the main articles in this month's edition of Our State magazine. Working for the weekend. Labor Day stirs memories of first jobs and inspires end-of-summer celebrations. Written by Susan Stafford Kelly. She has written so many articles. Cash money for babysitting and weed pulling was all well and good, but at 18 I was finally, legally, officially, if seasonally, employed as a waitress at a mountain resort near Elkin. For 2 weeks I've been lifting, lowering, and carefully rotating handled trio tubs of butter, sour cream, or bacon bits in my right hand, and Thousand Island, blue cheese, or Italian in my left. Now I held my first typed, crisp, perforated proof of labor, and something had gone terribly wrong. Someone named F.I.C.A. was apparently entitled to a chunk of my paycheck. My father's grinned observation was, "Welcome to the big leagues." 3 months of the 6 a.m. breakfast shift. Strawberry, grape, syrup, powdered sugar, stretched before me like a sentence. But by the time you're a real adult with a year-round job, your efforts get officially federally recognized, as they have been since 1894, with a day off from your toils. While not exactly sweet revenge, that first Monday in September, dedicated to lazing instead of laboring and being paid for it, is still pretty sweet. And while storm windows and leaf-raking puffy jackets and frosted windshields are still far away, you know that the sandcastle will likely be your last one you build, and this hike will be the last one before yellow leaves float by in the stream, and that the okra will shortly give way to pumpkins at the farmer's market. Evenings on the terrace, you hear oompa of high school band practice rather than the baseball stadium's muffled announcer. The local swimming pool will be drained to a gaping white hole and shutter its snack stand. And wasn't the last breaking wave you boogie boarded just the tiniest bit chillier? Whatever its official capacity as a national holiday, you know that unofficially Labor Day marks summer's end. Ironically, the very busyness that Labor Day seems to demand, new movies, new teachers, new clothes, sporting events, schedules, fall getaway plans, and a gamut of gearing up for a new season, can overshadow a day meant for relaxing. Don't let it. Instead, devote the holiday to recollecting, to fondly looking back at another glorious North Carolina summer that you were allotted. Remember the accomplishments. You taught a teen to slalom, to pitch a tent, to do a flip from a diving board. You helped a child ride a two-wheeler or discover a four-leaf clover while the dew still dampened the grass and his hands were still sticky with strawberry juice. Your first stab at making homemade hush puppies was a success, if you say so yourself. And so were your attempts at throwing a bait net. You're pretty sure no one else had ever happened upon that particular waterfall in that sun-dappled stream. Remember the guilty pleasures and somehow only summer permits. The extra scoop of mint chocolate chip, or a large order of seasoned fries, the beach books whose plots you've already forgotten but which spirited you away to England or California while your bare toes kept the glider gently to and froing. Who cares? War and peace will still be there next summer. The night you opened all the windows for the breeze, never mind the air conditioning humming through the vents. The daily trip to the dollar store with the grandkids for big league chew and blow pops. And oh, the people who populated your summers. Reunions at last with cousins or the folks next door who always rent the same week as you. Giggles around the grill, teasing around the table, charades and scavenger hunts and Scrabble and Old Maid, watermelon seed-spitting contests, singing finally around a campfire, belting out the Star-Spangled Banner from a bleacher with your best buddies, or a one-hit wonder from the bar stool on a pier, the nights in the porch, feet hoisted to the railing, a lap filled with a drowsy child or a dog or a paper plate limp with shrimp shells and cocktail sauce. The conversations that went nowhere but meant everything. There was that pesky summer cold, sure. A big toe sliced by an oyster shell. A week without the charger you forgot to pack. Mere nuisances compared to the summer's splendor. The luscious mouthful of a juicy peach swiped from a sun-warmed windowsill, the high, wide shade of a towering tree in full leaf, a bright riot of petunias and geraniums in a pot, the lazy current below your inner tube or canoe, a rumpled, overwashed seersucker suit for the Sunday church, the huge June moon. On this day, commemorating labor and effort and industriousness, remember, finally, before evening falls and the cookout coals crumble to ash, the grand, lovely slowness that is summer. Its lengthy, languid, idle days, its endless sunshine on mountain peaks, its glittering beaches and glassy lakes. Be glad and worry not. And now I think we're going to have to skip the next article because it's too long, and we'll go one over here. And this one should fit. Where does it start? Preserved with love. Canning with family and friends. Sharing our bounty. Turning old food traditions into new ones. These are just some of the ways that North Carolinians nurture relationships and build community. Mason jar memories, whether pickling the grapes that went into her family's jam or dishing out the fruits of her labor. This writer fondly recalls her childhood years canning at home in North Carolina, written by Susan Stafford Kelly. You can preserve the past and preserve a house. You can preserve your grandmother's wedding dress or a tress in a locket or a four-leaf clover between the pages of a book, but I equate preserving with food in a jar, in someone's kitchen, not in a factory. Credit where it's due, factories have gotten pretty darn good at preserving. There's a store-bought hot okra pickle that I'd put up against any of those of anyone else who's putting up okra pickles. What's lost in those rows of grocery jars is in the process of preservation itself, that all hands-on-deck day-long affair. On jelly-making day, my sister and I were assigned the task of picking grapes from our vines, competing with vicious territorial yellow jackets, feasting inside the split skins. Indoors, the kitchen was hot, humid, and cloudy, with steam from the water simmering in huge pots, the sterilized jars rattling like a handful of marbles, and grapes boiling on an another stove eye. I longed to be allowed to spoon off the vicious violet froth and knock it to the counter, where it gathered in folds and piles like purple lava. A Willy Wonka creation gone south. Hours later, my mother melted wax to seal the jars, and months later at breakfast, my sister and I would compete again, this time with each other, over who got to press out the thick wax and reveal the dark purple literal fruit of our labors. Stewed corn was even more labor-intensive and time-sensitive, since everyone knows that Silver Queen will quickly turn to starch in the fridge, so it must be picked and preserved in a single day. Shuck silk, then a sharp knife to be drawn down every single row of kernels, tiny as a baby's teeth, on every ear to split them before scraping. No whole kernels permitted. Turn the knife to the flat edge and re-scrape so the pale corn milk puddled on a plate. Butter, salt, double boiler. No sugar, no cream, and heavens knows no pepper. So the lemon white concoction with a nearly indescribable texture, more solid than grits but runnier than a squash casserole, isn't discolored with pepper flakes specks. Then came the from the kitchen of labels, which I'd proudly ordered from the Miles Kimball catalog as a gift for my mother. Later, from the dark nighttime kitchen would come the slight hollow puck noises, the metal rounds of mason jar lids sealing their rubber grip. There were the fads and trends, of course. Dilly beans were up there with stewed corn in meticulousness before the availability of haricot vert. Dilly beans meant pickling or finding, one by one, a batch of skinny, immature string beans prone to growing an inch a day. Thick beans don't pickle well, and if you miss stringing the bean before pickling, some future eater will need a toothpick. And since we're talking cocktail preserves, here's to the 70s hot pepper jelly, mounded upon many a slab of cream cheese and an easy intro for beginning preservers. For her chow chow, My mother scoured antique stores and junk shops in search of a crockery vat big enough to hold the relish makings. In my memory, the mint's stinky, fermenting contents sat on the counter for days on end before being ladled into jars. And clearer than any 4th of July recollection is the summer afternoon when I ambled through my grandmother's house and passed the sink filled with floating baby cukes on their way to becoming her famous bread and butter pickles. It was a delicacy so special that after she died, I couldn't bear to open the last jar she'd given me, turning it over and over like a snow globe, watching the spices float dreamily among the slices. As a child, you can't appreciate preservation that doesn't result in something sweet to spread on toast. The very appearance of pickled peaches, pale peeled balls in amber liquid with spiky cloves clustered at the bottom, forestalled any taste test until one Thanksgiving in my 30s. Now, it's Katie bar the door when those golden globes appeared. My mother and I barter annually over the tomato relish that one of her friends makes for Christmas presents. New Year's black-eyed peas are just pointless without a healthy dollop. Still, all the preserved foods that I've savored, there's one that I've never been able to rediscover or recreate. No doubt senses sharpen and memories exaggerate with time, but if there's a taste and texture sensation equal to a particular past experience with a watermelon rind pickle, I haven't found it. The rind was crunchy as a dill, but thicker, tougher, so the chew lasts longer. Yet the inside was tender as chess pie. It was purely and simply candy, a sweet, shiny, irregular chunk of edible emerald. If you have that recipe, you know, preserved somewhere, would you share? All right, now we're going to go to the beginning of the magazine just to hit a few very short items here. This is entitled their to-do list. I think we're only going to get time to read the intro. Discover the outdoors, from camping on the Outer Banks to practicing yoga on stand-up paddleboards to kayaking down Piedmont rivers. Joe Proia believes in the healing and empowering qualities of the outdoors. After 8.5 years spent working in outdoor recreation and education for women, Proia created Outdoor Women in January 2020, teaching activities such as kayaking, paddleboarding, hiking, and plant identification throughout the state to women of all experience levels. Nature heals mentally, emotionally, and physically, Proia says. We specialize in allowing in an empowered, educated, and supportive environment for women to reconnect with that love of adventure and the outdoors. To learn more about Outdoor Women by Joe Proia, visit OutdoorWomenByJP.com. And I guess I was thinking that was the lead-in. It is part of the to-do list, and I guess that was the first item. As time permits throughout the month, we'll hit the rest of the to-do list. But right now, we are out of time for this week's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, and on iTunes. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.